This is the 2014 All Hands Meeting of the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center. We're in a laboratory just across from the Supercomputer Center Auditorium, and we're with Guy Hoffman, who's just given a keynote talk. He's co-director of the Media Innovation Lab at the Interdisciplinary Center Herzliya in Israel. And you spoke about human-robot interaction.
Correct.
Embodiment and movement design, which was a lot of fun, lots of videos. Everybody liked it.
Everybody loves robots.
They love robots. Well, the most interesting thing for me, at least, was that you were showing some designs of robots which had come further and further and further away from the humanoid tendency, you know, making robots that look like humans.
Right.
By focusing on the specific expressions that were very easy for us to pass and understand. There is, as you know, this thing called the uncanny valley effect. The closer you get to making something that's uncannily like
a human,
people get a little bit freaked out. And the odd thing was that in your things, which would go completely the opposite way, almost like desk lamps and so on and so forth, they were still sweet and charming and understandable. I mean, do you want to talk about this? How you thought about that?
I mean, I would say they're even more acceptable when they don't look human. There's two ways to think about it. One is that maybe it's less threatening that they're so different from us. And therefore, our guards are down, and it doesn't fall into this uncanny valley because it doesn't seem to be like something that could be like us, or we have to measure it against what we know. And there's several theories, competing theories about the uncanny valley. People talk about why zombies are uncanny because they're almost alive but not quite alive, or why that has to do with our tendency to be careful about humans, whether there's something wrong with them. So all of these mechanisms seem to not be in place if we look at a desk lamp. But I come in part from animation. So I studied animation, and I looked at how animators take objects like tea kettles and desk lamps, or just dots and lines, and make them into something engaging by the way that they move. So I think actually the more something is less realistic or less like a human, we are willing to accept it more if it moves in the right way.
So rather than focusing on, and I mean this word accurately, not derogatorily, superficial perfection, in other words, of the surface, but of getting accuracy of the demonstrative act.
I think that we are. And again, this is sort of more of an intuition, that we are very sensitive emotionally to movement, to motion.
Yeah.
And that we can enjoy movement of many things, not just of human forms. So we can enjoy, you know, birds flocking in the sky that have no human form, and there's something almost as graceful as a like perfect ballet to it. Or we can enjoy, as I said, animated characters that just move around on the screen, and we have feelings about them. We attribute their own intentions and fears on them. So I wouldn't say superficial or expressive. I would say appearance versus behavior. And everything in the physical world has both appearance and behavior. And a lot of times I think with humanoid robots, the appearance is sort of leading us to think in a certain way. Whereas we can think about behaviors in a more subtle way, and therefore get a lot of more bang for the buck. And another thing why I'm personally interested in this kind of line of thinking, and I sometimes call it designing robots with movement in mind, is that if we want robots to be commercial, they have to be simple and cheap. But we can't have robots that are as uncomplicated as the human body. mass manufactured, at least not in the foreseeable future. So what kind of emotional effect, what kind of bond can we get with a robot that's simple, that's made out of a few spheres or just a few motors? And what I try to show with my robots is that you can get a lot of mileage from just getting the right kind of movement.
Yes, now, when I said superficial, meaning, I was literally using the word meaning surface of.
Right.
Why did you go in this direction, which is, you know, it's as if you did an about face from everybody else and said, well, I'm not going there. And
first of all, it's always good to go in a different direction than everybody else, right? So
whence came the idea and the initiative for doing that? What was the driver?
I've never actually thought about this question, but I'm remembering when I first worked at the MIT Media Lab, we had a very, very expressive humanoid robot that had 60 and 70, depending which worked different motors, and it was beautifully designed to be a very cute creature. And we were showing some effects we got of nonverbal communication between this robot and other humans, and then people said, well, obviously this robot is so cute, of course people respond to it. And I thought, no, it's not that it's so cute, it's the way it behaves. And I kind of wanted to prove that you don't need a robot to be cute for people to respond to it. And so I said, I can make people respond to a desk lamp if it moves the right way. And that's where sort of this, I was a student at MIT, and I was thinking, we got a lot of criticism, I think, for the fact that the robot, people thought that, you know, whatever behavior we put into, people will accept because the robot looks so great and the robot was beautiful. And I said, no, actually we can get the same or similar effects if we get a robot that just behaves in the right way.
So did you actually say that to Cynthia, to Cynthia Brazil? Because she was, she's somebody who's done a couple of things out with me on the Science Network, and we've had conversations before.
I mean, these criticisms came mostly from people outside the lab. I think Leonardo was an amazing piece of engineering.
Yes.
But I also thought this was not the kind of robot that people are going to have in their homes. You could do stuff with Leonardo that you couldn't do with any other robot. The kind of expressiveness that it had, and the kind of response it could evoke, was like the Rolls Royce of expressive robots. Like you couldn't do anything. But I was thinking, what can you get out of a Volkswagen Beetle? You know, Rolls Royce is great, but there's all this other spectrum, which I wanted to explore.
I don't think
it's like one instead of the other. It's just a different kind of angle to look at it.
No, I thought she'd have been interested in that and appreciative of that. I mean, she gave a keynote at the Cognitive Science Society meeting last year in Berlin, and showed some of the latest work with that and this kind of theory of other minds,
right.
Which was, you know, extraordinary to look at. But this, what you're talking about, the sort of robots with attitude.
Yeah.
Is very different and very interesting, especially when you showed those things where you've got, and I say robots with attitude, you've got very simple constructions effectively there, with a hip hop singer, but you can, you know what that desk lamp robot is doing, you know what it's, you know.
Right.
At least you think you know what it's thinking.
Part of the reason is that when these robots were designed, I tried to design them through the way they behave, and only then think what kind of appearance can support this behavior. Whereas usually when people design robots, they say, okay, I want this robot to have all these parts, and they have to fit together this way, and then we want it to look in a certain way. And then when the robot is completely constructed, they say, okay, how should this robot move? But now the robot already has all of its form, and I think these two are tightly coupled. So I try to design my robots from the beginning, from the way they behave, and this is why you saw these animation tests that I was doing to kind of get to the attitude of the robot before I decided where the motors are. So it's kind of like changing the way you think about robot design when first, usually you first build, you know, how the motors are structured, and then you think, how expressive can I make this? And I said, no, I'm going to start with how expressive it has to be, and then I'll put the motors just in the right place to get this expression. So that robot had an attitude before it was built. Mm. And it was built to have this attitude after I saw what it can bring out. So this maybe explains this a little bit.
And do you think that came from, so it was partly driven by your experience doing animation, or did the animation?
Oh, it's definitely, it came very much from my experience doing animation. Before MIT, I studied animation at Parsons in New York. And one of the first exercises you do as an animation student is they say, animate the circle to have three different personalities. And that was fascinating. So you just move a circle on the screen. You can't make it bigger or smaller. You can't make it, you know, have color. You just have to move it in a way that is confident or shy or angry. And that's where you sort of learn. You say, okay, if we move something the right way, there's a lot of emotion in there. And so when I started working on robotics, I thought we can use the same power of expression that Disney has known forever, and that there's an old animation called The Dot and the Line, where a dot falls in love with a line, and then they fight, and there's like the jazzy line that then is kind of more fun than the straight line, and they have all these interactions just with a dot and a line, and I think this kind of idea is what then brought me to think about robots the same way. My robots are sort of like dots and lines, but the way they move is what makes people maybe feel that they have an attitude. The marimba player was supposed to be kind of like a snobby, mischievous jazz player, and the speaker dog was supposed to be much more innocent and just liking music. And you can see this in the way that they behave.
Yeah. So go back, if you would, and tell me what the trajectory was that brought you to this. I mean, were you interested in art? Go back to being a kid in school. I mean,
being a kid in school.
What were you interested in then? What were your parents doing? What were they suggesting you should do? I mean, what were you reading? What was your favorite teacher?
So I was, first of all, I'm a Montessori kid. So I came up in the Montessori tradition where I never learned about Montessori, but for my memory is they just leave you alone,
yeah,
and let you enjoy school. That's what I remember. And I think going into the more structured part of education, I grew up in Germany and in Israel, so half of my childhood in each of the countries. And you kind of have to choose whether you're realistic, or they call it like in Hebrew realistic, or artistic. And I always felt this was a very bad dichotomy. Mm. And I felt that with the math kids, who I liked being around, I had too many artistic interests. And with the artsy kids, I had too many math interests.
Yeah.
And so I think for most of my childhood, I felt like I wasn't anywhere where, like, I didn't feel comfortable. And this went on through, I think, interdisciplinary is a word that's very popular today, but 30 years ago, that was not something that people were striving for, right? People were saying you're either this or that, and you have to choose if you want to be, you know, a math major or an arts major, and you can't possibly be both. And I think today, thankfully, the world is more open-minded about these things. So.
Well, I don't know. There's still these huge debates going on about the humanities versus the sciences, which is an echo of the two cultures thing from 40 years, 50 years ago.
Right.
And the humanities enrollments are going down.
I think that's a tragedy. So I was pretty much forced to play the piano as a kid, which I am now thankful for. But for many years, I hated it.
But yeah.
But I think that it's not like arts and humanities. I feel like they have to be the foundation of any sort of creative thinking. I honestly believe that even when you look at the pure, you know, scientific lab work, that in the end, there's subjectivity there. There's a way to think about problems. There's a way to decide what's important and what's not important. And I think, and there's also a sort of exploration and an exploratory joy that exists just as much in the art and humanities world. And I think the fact that this is being whittled down and that it's not profitable to some institutions, and I understand the considerations, but in the end, these kinds of ways of thinking are really what can open up new directions in a completely, you know, hardcore scientific ways. And I think these can also be the difference between incremental innovation and radical innovation, even when you're thinking about pure science.
Yes. So, but were you spending? What was the relationship between Israel and Germany? Were you spending half the year in?
No. I was in Germany until I was 13, and then we moved to Israel.
Okay.
So I moved to Israel kind of like towards the end of high school, middle school, I guess after middle school.
And the Montessori school part.
That was in Germany. It was in elementary school.
I noticed, incidentally, there was a huge piece I was reading the other day in The Economist or something about the massive increase of Montessori schools in China.
Yeah. So for me, Montessori school was just the local school. I mean, I came from a very I didn't come from a strong social economic background. So the Montessori school was just what the free public school that was in my neighborhood. And I think it also really comes to show that investment in you know, public education can really go a long way. I think if I never went to any special schools, but the countries that were in, the schools were just good.
Did you when you went to, had you already decided what you wanted to do when you went to university?
Haven't decided what I wanted to do.
Yeah, good. But did you do arts or sciences or what when you?
I enrolled in a very, so Israel has a very kind of a disciplinary attitude to undergrad education. So you actually have to choose your major, and basically the only subject you learn, you choose that before you apply. So you apply to study psychology at this university. So it's similar to the European system, but not exactly, but it's very different from the American system where you go to college and then you figure it out. But there was a small program of 15 students a year that was called the Interdisciplinary Program. And it's 15 students across the country that were taken as an experiment. They said, okay, let's put these kids, and we don't put them in any department, we put them in between departments, and they can pick whatever classes they want. And in the end, they have to pick one department that'll give them the degree, and then they spend the last year there. So it was very unusual. It's still going on. It's an amazing program. And so they basically let us loose and said, here's the whole curriculum from the whole school, just do whatever you want. And I almost finished all of the undergrad requirements for film school. So I studied a lot of film and screenwriting, and I had a lot of passion for film at the time. And I did mathematics, I did psychology, philosophy, biology, and computer science. So I picked things that were most interesting to me.
Yeah.
And in the end, I had to choose where I'm doing my final, you know, degree. And I ended up doing it in computer science because I found a professor, Professor Isharun, who was very open-minded. He was very interested in the relationship between cinema and computer science, and I did projects on video analysis, and that's where I got my degree. But I spent most of my first few years in undergrad in film school and in mathematics and in psychology, which might have seemed unrelated to anybody, but I thought they were interesting from the interesting points of view. And then what happened is that I then went to work on a film production, and I saw that this was very hard work. I was a production assistant. I was, you know, carrying things and driving people around. And I was like, wow, this doesn't feel like art at all. It feels like, you know, a factory job. And I'm like, well, I'm not sure that this is what I want to do. And then I thought maybe animation is better. You know, animation, I'm in my own little world. I can create my own world. And that's why I went on to study animation. And I learned a lot about animation and during that time. And then when I heard about this group starting at MIT that looks at personal robots and how robots communicate with people, I thought this would be a good connection, because it looks at robotics not as engineering, but it looks at it as an expressive medium in a way. And I had no idea what I was getting into, but it ended up to be an amazing place to work. That was
the Media Lab. I mean, it's
right. I didn't even know exactly about the Media Lab before. I really stumbled upon most of the good things that happened in life.
Well, so there's Cynthia's there. Cynthia Brazil, mm-hmm. doing the work with robotics. There's also Todd Mack over there, who's right. doing music and mm-hmm. opera and stuff. Great, great things.
Right.
So it's a very fertile place.
Yeah, it's definitely. I couldn't imagine being in any other place. It's.
Yeah. So how did you actually? So you then took your computer science mm-hmm. mixed with media, as it right. were, to that, and then.
So I think the computer science education really gives you, and today I believe actually that more and more people should learn how to program, should learn how to work with computers, and I think it gives you a certain way to approach a problem and empowers you to actually be able to solve it. When I got to Cynthia Brazil's lab, I started actually working on, beside the animation and the expressive motion, I was starting to think about collaboration, how collaboration works, and how a robot and a human can be teammates. And this was something that Cynthia was trying to get at, and I was one of the students on the team. And there we started to explore, when a team works together, what kind of nonverbal behavior can help the team achieve its goal. And so that's when I started to get more and more into this idea of timing of actions. How does a robot that works with a human together communicate what it's about to do, what it wants to do, communicates in its internal state. And I found that a lot of these ideas of timing that I got from animation actually also make sense in a team. And that's when my next kind of cross-pollination came, and I started getting interested in acting, in theater acting. And I met Janet Sonnenberg, who headed the theater department at MIT, and I started getting more and more reading about theater, reading about how actors prepare. And I had this strange notion, because I thought, in a way, our robots are kind of like actors in the human world, right? They just pretend to be something they're not, which is alive. In a way, actors are also trying to be believable in an external situation. And I said, what if I just go and study acting for a while? Maybe I'll get some new ideas. Mm. And I went and took acting classes and read like acting books, and ended up feeling that actors have actually solved a lot of the questions that artificial intelligence researchers are thinking about. And that was sort of the next step in this humanities science.
In what sense?
So there's a few things. When you think about someone building a robot that has artificial intelligence, and of course a robot is just a machine. There are a few challenges that you need to solve when you build a robot that you want to work with the human. One is, how does the robot seem like it's alive? How does the robot take whatever personality it is and translate it into motor commands? How do you take an idea, an emotion, and a personality, and convert it into a movement? This is basically the expressive robotic companion challenge, right? In the end, you have to drive the motors to have the robot move. And when I studied acting, I saw that this is exactly what they make us do in acting classes. You know, you take the whatever you want to convey and translate into your physical movement. The second point was this idea of responsiveness. A lot of the acting exercise we did was, how do you get the timing just right? How do you and another actor manage to synchronize your behavior? And this was the kind of thing that people with factory robots wanted to do between humans and robots. So it's kind of the same challenges, just on a different stage.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about a passage from something about Laurence Olivier, the great English actor, of course, where he'd done an extraordinary performance one day and suddenly came off the stage. All the other actors were, oh, he was amazing today. And he went straight off the stage, into his dressing room, slammed the door, vanished. Okay. And they were all, what should we do? And one of them was finally delegated to go and knock on the door. And, Larry, that was extraordinary. That was absolutely extraordinary, you know. And he said, yes, I know. Question is, I don't know how I did it and how I'll do it again. And it's this how do you repeat something like that? Whereas you're talking about something that will repeat things
routinely. It's saved on the disk, right?
Yeah.
So
the notion of the individuality there on the one hand, mm-hmm. the individual personality, and then you also have a section where you have your robots improvising, mm-hmm. playing jazz with you. One wonders how much it really is an improvisation. How much anything is really an improvisation?
Whether a machine can improvise.
Yeah.
I would say it
Whereas
can.
Whereas Larry, obviously, Olivier, obviously couldn't do the same thing perfectly, twice the same. Just couldn't.
I think, that's the repeatability side of improvisation, and then there's the surprise or maybe unexpectedness. And I think on both counts, a robot can improvise. I think it's, especially because of the robots that you saw improvising with the pianist, they use what the pianist is doing and use that as the basic data that from that
right.
they build it.
Right.
So in a way, unless the human does exactly the same thing at the exact timing, it will never be the same. And there's enough fluctuation in the system that for every performance, it's going to be a little bit different. And of course, at the end, the robots are programmed and there's one set of code. But if you get enough input from the human collaborator, and this is why I think that people often ask me, what if you just put two robots and improvise together? And I think it's less interesting. I mean, part of the idea is what does the robot pick up from the human and whether it can create something that's inspiring for the human in return.
Yeah.
And about the repeatability, I mean, this is basically the same. I mean, if you use the human as your inspiration, in real time, as the robot is playing, it will never be the same. I mean, humans are not the same. So as long as humans in the equation, usually it's a bad thing for robotics. You know that something's mm-hmm. unexpected. But in this case, it's actually good because the unexpected parts filter into the robot's behavior.
There was an interesting question at the end. Paula Talal asked you or mentioned having watched your the facial expressions and the responses for your desk lamp or whatever it was at the time, whether there was in fact an avenue, and you talked about this, about online therapy, that there's a kind of, that the robots could function in this really important space between being alone
right.
or being with somebody.
So
and you could still... And you actually made a comparison to saying that you thought they were a bit more like pets than they were like people. And you didn't think they had souls and they weren't totally human, but there was something interesting in the middle there that one could nevertheless still talk to.
I think robots are occupying an interesting space. And Sherry Turkle actually pointed that out in I would say, mid-2000s. When she said that people open up to robots might be not so much because of what they understand, but actually because of what they don't understand. And that in a way, when you're alone, you can be completely yourself. When you're with another, you get social support. So robots kind of get the benefit of both sides. You can get the sense of social support. And in our experiments, we are now showing that people actually respond to the robot responsive to them, seeming interested in what they do, seeming to, like when the robot seems to care about what they say, they respond in a very proto-social way. They respond to it similarly to how they respond to humans behaving in this way. But on the other hand, they also know that it's just a machine, so it can't really judge them. It can't really intimidate them. It can't really take their place. I think pets are a good example, because pets occupy a very similar space in the way that we do get a lot of, you open the door, the dog comes running. Is the dog happy about you coming back? Who knows? Maybe the dog just has like a circuit that makes it run to the door when it opens. But we understand this in a social way, so we get the social benefit without having to worry about the dog judging us, right? Mm. Without having to worry about the dog be feeling superior to us. So I think robots, and in this case, could serve a very similar role. And especially, we were talking with this research we were doing, we were talking with my collaborator, Gurit Birnbaum, about the idea that maybe in cases where it's not appropriate for someone to talk to a human, maybe in cases when it's sensitive information, maybe it's in cases when someone experienced some trauma, it might be better to converse with a robot. Not because it's, not because I think that people should not talk to each other. Obviously, I don't think robots should replace relationships, and this is something I'm being asked a lot. But I think that in certain cases, it might be more beneficial to occupy the space between social and solitary. And robots could play an interesting role there.
Robots replacing relationships. I mean, I suppose that's part of the whole thing about communing solely and in an isolated fashion with technology rather than with your peers, right, and so on and so forth. And I suppose that the new movie Her is kind of an extension of that, and so on and so forth. Do you want to expand on that for a second? I mean, where do you think that is going? So all right. So I'll give you another road in. So you're on the Colbert Report.
One of my robots was used
on the Colbert Report. Yes, one of your robots was there.
The robot was there.
And so Stephen Colbert was talking about making some very funny jokes. Because this is the jazz playing. Mm-hmm. Improv robot, which he called, what was it, Thelonious Junk. Robots with attitude. Making some funny jokes about that. But earlier, you had also made the point that you, I wrote this down, you said, I can't believe robots have souls or consciousness.
Right.
So this territory of how we liaise with, what relationships we have with
these machines.
These machines, yeah.
I think I'm a big humanist. I believe that people should spend more time with each other. I would not be opposed to shutting down the cellular network forever, and having people have to meet for everything they want to exchange. I'm not a big technology fan,
Right, right.
So I think robots are interesting tools for us to understand more about how we interact. And I think robots can serve in certain roles that might be important in the current economy, in the current demographic situation, where it's not that all these people living alone are now talking to friends, and now they're going to be talking to robots instead. I think there's a big movement towards solitary living. There's a big movement towards detachment from each other and from social life. And I think it's being driven. Didn't start today. This is the story of post World War II, the developed world of people being more further apart, living more solitary lives. People living into old age and having less social connections. So I think I don't want robots to replace human relationships, but I want us to think how robots can enhance human relationships.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've been thinking about recently is whether a robot can support more human face-to-face communication. And actually, for me, robots are better than smartphones. Because they don't make you look into a screen of information, but actually make you maybe lift your head and be in the spatial world. So I definitely understand this concern. I think this concern is true, and I think it has nothing to do with robotics. I think it has to do with the way that we are addicted to information, that we want to do everything quicker and more precisely. And this is a trend that I'm just as concerned about as anyone, if not more. So
do you think do you see yourself continuing on this trend, working with robots, or do you foresee yourself morphing into yet another career as you go along?
I'm currently very much interested in this career, so yeah. I think the next 10 years are going to see a big shift in the roles robots play in our lives. And I think I want to be part of having some influence on what these robots will look like, what they will behave like, and what roles they play. And I think I'm in a very lucky position of having thought about these questions for a little bit of time, thanks to the places that I've happened to be, with Cynthia Berlin's Media Lab, with Gil Weinberg at Georgia Tech, and some of the pioneers of this field. And now I feel like our community of human-robot interaction is going to go forward into the next 10 years, and we'll try to shape how robots are going to come into our lives. I think we shouldn't think about this as just a technological question. It's a humanities question. It's an emotional question. It's an ethical question. And I think I definitely want to be part of helping to define what kinds of robots we're going to have in our homes, in our schools, in our hospitals.
I was going to say, more robots in the schools, in the educational system, you think?
Definitely. Yeah. I think, and again, we're saying, this is horrible. Why would we want robots to come into our schools? But what we're doing, unrelated to robots, is having greater and greater disparities between good schools and bad schools, having, some people with access to it having an amazing education, and then countries falling behind with no education. And I think the social problems in our world are not being created by technology, and I think we should be sensitive and try to create technology that helps alleviate this. And again, perhaps I'm going to say something that might come out very controversial, but I think we shouldn't ask ourselves if we're replacing like a robot in a classroom instead of a human in a classroom, but maybe we have a robot in a classroom in a village that doesn't have a classroom, and now could have a classroom because of this. Hmm. So I would never say that it's better to have a robot in place of a human, but I would say that robots can help us fill those gaps that are being created by all the other trends that are happening in the world. And I would like to definitely to have some sort of influence on how we do this, and to do this with the right kind of sensitivity that will make our future not dystopic. And I think if we leave it up to technologists, this might we might end up with only efficiency and some sort of optimal solution. But I think especially if we are going to have technology more and more in our lives, which is happening, We need to have these sensibilities to make it more graceful or more respectful of our humanity than just thinking of what problems it can solve.
Hmm. So, have you noticed a difference in the way things are received? These kind of ideas are received in Europe, States, Israel.
I think every country has its own kind of cultural bias. Yeah. People have, it is considered well known that Japan is very open,
sure,
to robotics, and there have been several theories about this. I'm not particularly sure. I think from my experience, the United States is fascinated by technology, is fascinated by statistics, and it's fascinated by data, So I think this is kind of what people are most interested in here. In Israel, actually, robotics is not very well developed. So I don't think I have any big insights on the difference between the cultures. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things which definitely are very different is the attitude towards immigration, which drives a lot of this interest in having robots in different places because, you know, Japan, for example, is just is a set of islands, right? So you can't grow out much more. So they have a different attitude towards immigration, and they try to think maybe this can solve the problem. But again, I don't have too much intelligent things to say about this.
Yeah. Do you actually have students as well? Do you teach students?
Yeah, I have many students.
Right. So I assume so. But I mean, do you have any? What kind of advice do you give students, having gone through a very unusual trajectory yourself? I mean, what do you suggest to them when they say?
I tell my students the following thing. I tell them that our life expectancy is very high these days, so they should take it slow. I tell them that I didn't know what I was going to do with my life until I was almost 40, and that if they don't know what's going to happen when they're 25, they can take a deep breath and relax because it's not necessary to know. So my main advice to them is that they should really explore different ways of being, different things they can do, and they shouldn't worry about them. It's always funny to me, they come to me when they're 25 and they say, I'm 25 and I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. And I said, you're only 25. I'm 25. I haven't even heard about the word robot when I was 25. You know, I think kids today are kind of nervous about their future, and I think it has to do with the economic situation. But I was I also tell them, don't I was living with roommates until well into my 30s, you know, because I thought it was more interesting to do something interesting and not to worry too much about my material, you know, situation. And I think that's good advice for young people. I think they should travel, they should explore different things, and they might make interesting connections that they can't think about if they only look at, like, what do I have to do to get to a certain point. Maybe they should just try to go to a different point or no point at all, and then the connections might happen. So take it slow, relax, explore, travel, and do things and do things that grow your mind and make you more curious and more interested, rather than things that get you to some sort of career or material goal that in the end, you know, it's not sure that will make you happy.
Well, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic about everything. What am I optimistic about?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the more we know about each other and about humanity, people will get more peaceful and more tolerant.
And the robots, in fact, are, curiously enough, a vehicle that helps in that quest, you would say, or not? Or
I hope that robots will play a positive role in helping us communicate with each other, and also helping us live more, you know, live better lives. But as someone who's very involved in technology, there's one rule: you only predict the past, you never predict the future. You know? Because I always tell people, my big accolade is that when I first saw YouTube, I said that's never gonna catch on. And so that's how serious my predictions should be taken.
Yeah.
I said, you know.
I once had was having a conversation with a science fiction writer, Ray Bradbury. And I said to him, well, so Ray, I mean, you're in the business of predicting the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
He said, no. He said, I'm actually in the business of preventing possible futures.
That's a good point.
Because, you know, you could see where he was going with that. Do you think that you'll get to a point where the dance and movement and so on, the kind of thing that Wayne McGregor does with the Royal Ballet and so on and so forth, that's been analyzed here by some of the CogSci guys here, is that the sort of thing that you think will be interesting to you as well? Is that something you might move into? Or?
Yeah, I think that animation, theater, and dance, all these things are interesting to me, but they're interesting to me because I would like all the interaction between us and technology to be like a dance. So not specifically to make dance more robotic or having robots in dance, because I think humans are good enough at this. But learning from dance to make a robot that works in a factory, you know, assembling whatever you're building, make you feel like you're dancing with a robot. Mm. I think that would be great. So if you have a robot that helps my grandmother to put dishes back in the cabinet, which is difficult for her, I would like her to feel like she's dancing with a robot, and she's not just operating a crane. Mm. Now that would be, I would be happy to retire with that.
Well, I think that's a nice note to end on. Dancing with robots.
Dancing with robots.
Good to see you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.